We are, after a brief excursion to the other world, we are back to the Torah. This morning, I want to spend, a reasonable amount of time, we'll see how long, on what you might call the creativity of Jewish interpretation. I will explain what I mean by that in just a moment. We're in Genesis chapter 24, so let's all first find where we are. Abraham has bought the first plot of land in Israel, which is a grave for his wife Sarah at Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, and he's buried her. And there is one great task of Abraham's life that remains unfulfilled, which is he's got to get his kid married, right? Obviously, there is no continuity if there are no grandchildren. So he has to get Isaac married. And as you know, in traditional societies, it is not the job of the child to get him or herself married. It's the job of the parent to find a suitable mate for the child. Now, despite the fact that in a brief while Abraham himself is about to have a whole bunch of kids, which is a strange coda to the story, right? And those kids aren't really talked about at all. They just sort of disappear into the mists of history, and why that's there is not clear, but we'll talk about it when we come to it. Despite the fact that he's about to have all these kids, he seems to be too old to go find a wife for Isaac himself, and so, as we will discover in a moment, he is going to send his servant Eliezer with instructions where to go and what to do to find a wife for Isaac. But first, I want to spend a lot of time on the very first sentence, and it'll become clear why I want to do that in just a second. I want to read it to you first in Hebrew and then in English, okay? Va'avraham zaken. Abraham was old. Ba bayamim means literally came in days. That's the literal meaning. It's another way of saying old. But zaken ba bayamim is a Hebrew phrase that's used several times in the Bible, and it just means he was old. Okay? Vahashem, and God berech et Avraham bakol, has blessed Abraham in everything. Now, there are several things in this verse that cry out for exegesis. Exegesis is interpretation, right? And that's exactly how you say it in Hebrew. You say that a verse, Vayomer Darsheni, and it says, interpret me, right? Like, verses cry out literally for interpretation. So first of all, it says that Abraham was old. Why does it explicitly say he was old? This is the first person in the Bible who is called old, okay? So the rabbis say, Abraham, and this will, in a nutshell, right here, if you want the difference between the Jewish point of view and the point of view which we grow up with, here it is. The rabbis say Abraham was the first man who merited, who got the zechut, the honor of looking old. Right? Which means that, unlike today, looking old was considered an honor, and old people were venerated, and looking old was a good thing, and that's why the Torah goes out of its way to tell you, guess what? Abraham got the honor of looking old. By the way, Hebrew word for beard, anyone know? Zakan, right. Same letters, just different vocalization. So Abraham is old, and that also sets up, of course, the fact that he's now especially worried about getting a wife for Isaac, presumably also because before this, he thought Sarah would take care of it. That was more Sarah's job than his job, but now Sarah's gone. And Abraham, who has always taken care of his responsibilities, right? He went to war to save Lot. He took care of his household. He's now going to make sure that Isaac is taken care of. The other word in the sentence that requires interpretation is bakol. What does it mean that God blessed Abraham with everything? And here, I'm going to give you many interpretations and then one very deep one. This is Iturei Torah. Iturei Torah is a collection of Hasidic interpretations on the Torah, okay? This is the volume on Genesis. So I looked up Bakol here, and it has about, 12 or 15 different interpretations of that one word. And remember, this is only Hasidic interpretations, right? And this is only one book of Hasidic interpretations, but I thought, okay, but you'll see how it works. V'Avraham Zaken Baba Yamim, Abraham is old, advanced in age. And then it says, Ba im kol hayamim, he came with all of his days, because all of his days were full and none of them had a lack. In other words, every day contributed to him. They were all full, and when he came to you with all of his experience, with all of his days. So that's what it means with he came with his days and bakol tied together. All right? That's one interpretation. Here's the next one. I only underlined some of them. Some of them are, either repetitious or I think not as... what does it say in the creation story? God called the day light and the night darkness. And when you say someone came with all his days, what does it mean? That Abraham was all light in his days, right? Harkening back to the creation story. And you will see again and again in these interpretations that nobody interprets in a vacuum. They always interpret with previous Torah comments brought to this one, and I'm going to give you a good example of that in just a couple of minutes, okay? Here's another one. And this one just says, Bisfarim Shonim, which means this is given in various books, okay? Ba im kol yamav, he came with all of his days, not one of them was lost. And here it says... all of his days contained at least one good deed, so that all of them counted in the accounting when he came before God, right? There wasn't a single day where God said, well, I can't count that one in your favor because you didn't do anything good that day. Every day of Abraham's life, he did something that counted in his favor. So when he came before God, he came with all of his days, right? Okay. I'll skip that one. Not so great. How about this one? All right. This one quotes from the Talmud and gives a wonderful explanation. It says, Rabbi Meir Omer, Bekol. Rabbi Meir said with all, what does it mean? That he did not have a daughter. So what is the interpretation here? Because remember that you're supposed to have two children, a son and a daughter. So the fact that they would say Bekol and he didn't have a daughter calls for a special explanation. So he says, what does it mean that he didn't have a daughter? And you'll see in a minute that it's not exactly what you think. First of all, Bekol in Gematria, Bet Kaf Lamed, is the same as Ben. Bet Nun. Nun is 50 and Kaf Lamed are also 50. So when it says Bekol Hayamim, it's clearly indicating that he had only sons and not daughters, and that's why they said Kol. Okay, Gematria is, remember that, I'll give you a quick reminder, in Hebrew, in classical Hebrew, there was no way to write one. You wrote Aleph. There was no way to write two. You wrote Bet, right? Numbers and letters were identical. So every word you wrote had a natural numerical value. It wasn't that you were playing a game. Every word did, in fact, have a numerical value. Kaf is 20, Lamed is 30, and Nun is 50. So 20 and 30 equal 50, but Kol is the same as Ben, okay? They're both 52 in Gematria. One second. So he interprets, what is the Ketav Sofer? I love this. I think you'll like it too. He says, what does it mean that he doesn't have a daughter? Because that means that he didn't have to get his daughter married off, which always causes people great, great worry and great strife, right? And this reminds me, there was an episode of the... of the West Wing. It was a great episode where he talks about the fact that he, as he traveled through the Middle East, people used to call him, I think it was Abu Banim. And he didn't know what Abu Banim meant, but all he knew was that they were incredibly nice to him as he and his family traveled through No, Abu Banat. I don't remember what it was. Anyway, the point was that there was the Arabic phrase that meant father of daughters. And they all felt bad for him because he only had daughters, and so they were especially nice. And here the same thing, which is that it's a lot easier to marry off a son than to marry off a daughter is always a problematic proposition. And so when he blessed Abraham with everything. Now, the funny thing is that there is a Talmudic statement. Rabbi Meir says it means that he had no daughter. Then there's another Talmudic statement that says when he blessed him with everything, it means he had a daughter, which is peculiar, first of all, because Abraham doesn't have a daughter, although he will later on. But it's based on, as I said, the Talmudic principle that that you're considered done in childbirth when you have a son and a daughter, right? And there are stories about that in the Talmud, about people who sought to have one or the other. Okay, so that's that. One second, I have a few more to go through. What does it mean that Abraham blessed everything, was blessed with everything? It says, a true tzaddik doesn't pray only for himself, but he prays for everyone. Kulo. Bakol kulo. Same word. So when it says Abraham was blessed with everything, it meant that Abraham, through Abraham, everything was blessed. Okay? And that's what it means that Abraham's blessed bakol. Here's another one. When it said the most famous kol phrase is what? Bechol levavecha. Right? And that's what it means. It says that what it means with Abraham is b'chol avavecha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol me'odecha. That Abraham did all the kol. He loved God with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might. And that's what it means that he was blessed b'chol. Here's yet another one that says that what it means b'chol is, the Hebrew is shehu sholet b'yitzro, which is a way of saying that Abraham had control of his yetzer hara, right, of his evil inclination. And anybody who can master their evil inclination is blessed with everything. They have all the inclinations and they have mastery over them, right? He didn't have surgery on his evil inclination. He still had an evil inclination, but he was able to master it, so he was blessed with everything. Here is yet another one. Yes, so, shehistapek bakol, that he was satisfied with everything, that he took joy in all things. He never felt a lack. He always felt like he was filled up. That's another answer of Bakol. Let me just do two more. I think just two more, and then I'll take questions and comments because there are a couple of them. Those of you who know the Birkat HaMazon, Lo Yichzuru Kol Tov, right? Lo Yichzuru Kol Tov means God will not withhold any good thing. God blessed Abraham with every good thing, because again, the word kol. You can hear the rabbis sort of running through their book that has a mention of every the word is escaping me at the moment, but I'll think of it. The Evan Shoshan has it. The concordance in their head that tells them every instance of kol, right, in the Bible, and they're trying to figure out how it applies to Abraham. There's a book that will tell you, if you want to know how many times a word occurs in the Bible and in what forms, you open it up and it will tell you every word and in what form. It's called a concordance. Okay? Then finally, two more. In Gematria, again, remember every word has a number. Kol is the same as shofar. Okay? Hashem Beirech Avraham Bakol, Bakol Bimlo Av. Bet Chaf Lamed Begamatria Shofar, and it means that from him came the shofar because of the Akedah. And that's what it's saying. God blessed him with everything. What did he bless him with? Remember, it's the shofar that is going to announce the coming of the Messiah. So Abraham is blessed Bakol. He's blessed with being able to announce the end of things. And then finally, not in here, and then I'll give you the deepest one of all. First I'll give you this, then I'll take questions, and then I'll do the deepest one because it'll take a while. Harold Kushner has a really nice interpretation of this that's not mentioned in any of the books. He said Abraham's life was a hard one. He had pain, he had suffering, he had joy, he had loss, he had everything. He was blessed bakol, right? Because really to be blessed with everything is to be blessed with both good and bad. And that's his interpretation. Okay, yes.
He's only old in actual years, but he still has a vitality, and if he didn't have
It depends how you see. Right. There is a precedent for that in the Bible. It says, for example, when Moses died, that his eye was undimmed, and also it's certainly evidenced by the fact that he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 children in the beginning of chapter 25. So something is undimmed here. And that may be, by the way, that may be the source for the comment that his Yetzer Hara is still alive in him, but he masters it, right? Because the Yetzer Hara is also considered to be part of the spring of the sexual impulse. And there is this famous story in the Talmud that the rabbis once tied up the Yetzer Hara, they caught it and tied up the Yetzer Hara, and not an egg was laid and not a child was born, right? So, yeah, go ahead.
Saying to himself, I've really been blessed in everything, even though it was hard. And it seems to me that also that the fact that he's making this accounting now is what leads him now to say, oh, but there's one thing I haven't done yet, and that's found in the sun for Isaac.
I think that fits really nicely, and also it accords with our experience. People do take an accounting as they get older and think back over their lives and think, I've done this and I haven't done that. Are there things that I still have left to do that I could still do? And those of you who are on Off the Pulpit, who get the Off the Pulpit emails, they're sending out, I hope today, in addition to the regular Off the Pulpit, an article that I just wrote that appears in this month's Moment magazine about being at the bedside of someone who was dying. And it, clearly that's part of the issue is, how do I evaluate my life? And part of what I said at the time, and I've said to other people, is that how you die can also be part of your legacy to your children and grandchildren, because people watch how you handle it. Anyway, so if you want to get that, just contact my office or write to offthepulpit@sinaitemple.org. And I talk about the fact that I study each week with a man who's now 90, and he still remembers what his mother said to him before she died. And it comes back to him all the time. She said to him, don't be afraid. This happens to everyone who ever lived. And he still remembers it. So,
that's good advice.
Anyway, yeah.
Isn't it sort of what we do at every Yom Kippur? We review?
Yes.
Like yearly?
Right, and the reason you review at Yom Kippur is because that's when you face your death. Right? I don't know if I'm going to live or I'm going to die, so I'm going to evaluate my life and try to figure out whether it's been good or not. Yes, please. Because boys have property, they inherit from their father, and also because just the way traditional societies worked, right? Every man who has economic possibilities can marry a woman, because women are looking for economic security, right? She can't go out and get a job. So she has to find someone who will provide for her in a class. I mean, I'm talking now about a classical society. So if she doesn't get married, she faces the possibility of poverty, unless she's lucky enough to be born to wealthy parents. But a man can go out and work and get a job. So in classical societies, it was women who had to worry more. That's why the famous opening of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, right? I can't quote it exactly, but something like, you know, it is a settled fact that any woman, right, of a certain age is in want of a man to marry. That's much less adept than what is it?
Yes, it's a man,
you sure?
Who's in possession of a large fortune must be in want of a wife.
Must be in want of a wife.
Yes.
If he's in large of a fortune.
So
there you go. So forgive me, Jane, and I'm glad that you corrected. Now I have to go up and look at it. But for a woman who doesn't have money, that's her only possibility of getting along well in this world.
But then, I guess Korah is looking at it as a material thing, because if you want to find the right person, it's not the material things. It will be the same.
Are you talking about for a woman?
Yeah, for both.
If you want to eat, if you want to eat, you have to find the right person, though, is also somebody who can provide for you. If it's someone who doesn't provide for you, then it's probably not the right person.
So
right?
That's just one aspect.
Well, it is one aspect. But don't forget also, provide for you depends on what your standard is, right? Provide for you can't just mean who puts food on the table, which is a fairly, it doesn't mean that it has to have, you know, a house in the flats of Beverly Hills, right? That's a different level of providing. But I think that it's the wisdom. I mean, this is why you get constantly, this is like the classical plot in movies and books, is woman wants to marry a man that the parents don't like because they don't think he'll provide for her, right? And in the end of the story, of course, if he doesn't provide for her, it doesn't work, right? The end of the story almost always is, in fact, he turns out to be, you know, who knew that he was going to turn out to be a wealthy rock star or something like that. But anyway, yeah.
When we read the sentence and you said it's crying for explanation, I was under the impression when Abraham Bacol means he blessed Abraham with the land he promised him and he has already made him a goy gadol.
Mm-hmm.
Because on chapter 12 it says, I'll make you a goy gadol.
Right.
In the future you become. So it's like, well, I don't have the land still. And so that's the question. Maybe Bacol means inner that it will happen
because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it certainly is true that he hasn't given Abraham what he promised him, unless he promised it to the future, which is why he turns to Isaac. But yeah, there is this contrast here. Why would you say he blessed Abraham Bacol when Abraham hasn't gotten the stuff that God said that he would give him? So, yes.
Would you refresh my memory as to why difficult things are considered a blessing? Is it because we survive them?
It's not a question of refreshing your memory. I mean, difficult things are considered a blessing in people's lives generally because it deepens them, broadens them, makes them understand life better, enables them to help others better. There are lots of reasons, depending on the difficult thing, right? So, I would say that no difficult thing, like no good thing, is just a blessing, right? It's both. But how you regard it, I think, is, I mean, look, Kushner is a good example. Obviously, what happened to him wasn't a blessing, but he turned it into a blessing. That doesn't mean that it was, that if you were weighing it up in the scales, it ends up being a blessing, but is the fact that his son died and he turned that into something that helped millions and millions of people, does that mean that he enabled his son's death to be a blessing, even though it's also obviously a dark thing? Yeah, so, okay. Now let me turn to the Mei HaShiloach. And let me first explain something about the Mei HaShiloach. Nobody understands anything he says. That's the first thing that I have to explain. And that's unfair. Mimi Feigelson, who teaches at the American Jewish University, is an expert in the Mei HaShiloach, and she understands him. She and about like 10 other people. It's very difficult to study him because he's very elliptical, which means he gives you one word and assumes that you'll understand the other 10. And because his mind makes leaps and because he thinks very differently from most rabbis. But now and then, you read a comment by him that's actually pretty, pretty straightforward. And I'm going to read you one that is by he's the Izbitzer Rebbe. That is by the standards of the Izbitzer Rebbe, pretty straightforward. But you'll see, it's also very typical in how elusive, with an A, which means he alludes to other things, how elusive it is. And that's because for a traditional commentator of Torah, everything in Torah comments on everything else in Torah. All right, you're not just reading the story of Abraham. If I know a verse, as you'll see in a minute from Zechariah, from the prophet Zechariah, who lived long after Abraham, that uses the same word as one of the verses in Abraham, then obviously Zechariah is talking about Abraham. That's the way traditional interpretation works. Okay. V'Avraham zaken b'bayamim, v'Hashem berech Avraham b'kol. That's the verse that we just read. Abraham is old, advanced in days, and God blessed him in everything. So, he says, he takes a verse from Kohelet, from the book of Ecclesiastes. And this is my portion from all my work, and it is. Okay? What's the reward from all my work? That's the verse that he takes from Ecclesiastes. I can give you the verse. It's written in here if you want to look it up, but we'll just soldier on through. Now, on that verse in Ecclesiastes, okay, not on our verse, but on that verse in Ecclesiastes, there's a discussion in the Talmud. What reward does the person in Ecclesiastes get for all his work? Because he doesn't say what the reward is. Now, who wrote Ecclesiastes? according to the tradition, Solomon. So the question is, what reward did Solomon get for all his work? You with me still? Good. Rav and Shmuel are two rabbis who are always arguing in the Talmud, okay? Constantly. One of them said his staff and the other said his water jug. Now, staff and water jug don't seem like much of a reward for a king to get for his work, so obviously they mean this symbolically. So now you have to explain what the symbolism is of Rav and Shmuel's comment on the verse in Ecclesiastes. And this, by the way, is all like two sentences in him. Okay, so. So let's see. Surely Shlomo didn't feel that he was lacking anything or needed any kind of reward in this world from all the work that he had done. But what it means is that, I'll skip a little bit. It means that the staff is his power of action in the world, right? The king's staff. That's what the staff represents. And what does a jug represent? His receptivity. Because, he says in here, there are two separate kinds of power that a human being has. His power to act in the world, which he calls his expansive power in here, and his receptive power. And that's what Rav and Shmuel were really saying about Solomon is, those were the two things that he had. Remember, Solomon's considered the wisest person in the Torah. So obviously he has the ability to receive, that's the water jug. But on the other hand, he was a king who expanded the borders of Israel. So obviously he has the ability to expand, that's the staff. Okay? So far, so good. All right. Now he says, then he quotes, Umatzinu shemakel romez al chayim. How do we know that the staff is about life? Because in a verse in Zechariah, right, it says, they shall walk in the streets in Jerusalem, everybody with his staff in his hand. So he's using the verse in Zechariah to show that it says old people will walk in the streets of Jerusalem with the staff in their hand. It's like showing vitality of old people, and now you understand how it's going to come back in some way to Abraham, right? So that vitality can apply to Abraham, but the one who says the water jug is kli kabul. It is a vessel of receiving. And this is the essence of living in this world. Okay, the essence of living in this world is the ability to receive. Not the ability to act, but the ability to receive, because all action is based on receiving. And this finally, I'm saying finally, he doesn't say finally, is the meaning of the sentence, Avraham Zakein Baba Yamim. Baba Yamim now means all the days came to him. Right? That's what he's saying, is that he got Sheba El Shoresh Hachayim. He went to the roots of life. Abraham did. He penetrated to the roots of life. V'haya kli l'kabel, and he became himself a vessel of receiving. Okay, he was the one who took in, because he had gotten to the roots of life, everything that came to him, he took in and was able to add to life everything that God had given him, even more. In other words, not only did he receive what God gave him, but added to it, because he got down to the roots of life and was able to receive everything that life had to give him, and obviously then could turn around and act. So that's his interpretation of Bakol. Now, it's clear when you read something like that, that Bakol has, I mean, it's very far from the pshat, from the simple meaning of the verse. But he sort of takes a tour through scripture, which means both Bible and Talmud, to arrive at what he understands to be the essence of Abraham's life. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because Abraham has gone through lots and lots and lots of different experiences, right? And now, at the end of his life, having received all this, what shows that he's received it and is able to pass it on? The fact that he's going to transmit that to his son, who is going to carry on Judaism. So Isaac is going to be the receiver of everything that Abraham gives him. And do you remember what it is that Isaac does? What does Isaac do in his life that reflects his legacy from Abraham? Anyone remember?
Rebuilds the wells.
The wells. He rebuilds the wells that Abraham first dug. Which reminds you of what that I just read? It's the water jug, right? It's the water jug. Abraham, having made himself gotten down to the shoots of life by digging the wells in the first place, and notice that the Mashiach doesn't even bother to tell you this, right? Abraham, having dug the wells in the first place and made himself a vessel of reception, now he's going to pass that on to Isaac, okay? That's a very typical sort of comment from, there are a couple, the Mashiach isn't the only one. There are a couple of Hasidic commentators who talk about the Bible in that way. But you can see that there is, that's all from that one verse, and that's all Hasidic interpretation, right, that I just gave you from those two books. Okay, any other questions or comments before we actually move on to what happens in the Torah?
Well, just when did
yes.
he live?
19th century, Isbicher was in Poland, and I can tell you, well, that's the publication date. But I don't have his, I can find out and I can I'd be happy to give you his biographical details. It doesn't, I don't know if it has a brief, but sometimes they have a brief biography in the beginning. Let's see. Isbicher, and it doesn't, let's see. I'll check. I will check. Yeah.
God was blessing him as opposed to modifying the object of Abraham. So instead of it being blessed with what he was being blessed with, it's talking about how God blessed him.
How, but what is it modifying? What other word is it modifying?
Adonai Berech.
So but Bakol means with everything.
Right, but so it's with God's doing it with all of his everything. God, well, with all of God's
so it's modifying God's everything.
Right, how God is blessing as opposed to what Abraham is receiving.
It. I mean, I'm not sure that you could work it grammatically, not that that matters in interpreting a Torah verse. Because it says, Berech Abraham Bakol, with everything, and that's the end of the, and grammatically, if it's going to modify God, it's Bakol Shelo, or Bakol Shehu Natan Lo, or
no,
Bakol something.
It would be Adonai Barach Bakol at Abraham.
Right. Or that would also work. But it doesn't work Barach et Abraham Bakol. Not, I mean, it's let me put it this way. It's very stretched. And also, if it's Bakol, that would mean that he, if it modifies God, it means God blessed him with everything God has, which is almost blasphemous. You mean God doesn't have anything else? God's omnipotent. He should be able to bless him with, you know, although it is possible that giving somebody of Abraham's age five more kids is a demonstration of omnipotence. But anyway, if you could make it work meaning-wise, it might work grammatically, but I'm not sure how it works meaning-wise to say that God gave Abraham everything that God had. Yeah. It's from the Talmud.
Oh, it's from the Talmud.
Right.
And one should be boy and the other girl.
It's not should. It's saying that if you have a boy and a girl, you have fulfilled the mitzvah of peru or vu, of be fruitful and multiply.
So the people who cannot have children or they have boys only or they have girls, they have sinned?
No. Not fulfilling a mitzvah is not the same as sinning.
Oh.
There are a lot of mitzvot you will never fulfill in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. Lots of them.
But that's something you don't have any
choice. A lot of them you have no choice about. Right? I will never be able to fulfill the mitzvah of bringing a sacrifice to the temple. I have no choice, but I can't fulfill the mitzvah. That doesn't mean that I've sinned. It just means that that's a mitzvah that I haven't had the zechut of being able to fulfill in this world. I mean, look, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Soloveitchik, a lot of famous rabbis had no children. They were not able to fulfill that mitzvah. Does that mean that they sinned? No, it means that for whatever reason, they couldn't fulfill that mitzvah. There are, by the way, other opinions in the Talmud as well. Some say with two children you fulfill it no matter what. Some say only with a boy and a girl. But the point is they had to try to, when God says be fruitful and multiply, then you have to try to decide what that means, right? What does that mean? So they said that this mitzvah, if you fulfill it, you fulfill it by doing this. Yeah. Yeah.
If this is all Hasidic,
yes.
Could you give us an example of something that's not
Hasidic? Well, I did. I gave you several examples buried in the Hasidic literature of when they said that this means, for example, that he had a daughter or he didn't have a daughter. Those are all Talmudic. So, yes?
Since we're talking about pictures as well, isn't the name Mea Shiloh
also? Yes, I was actually debating in my mind whether to bring that up, right? Mea Shiloh means water from the well. But exactly so. And I thought, you know, I don't know exactly how to make something of that, so I didn't, but yes, that's the name he chose for himself. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Well, it is, I mean, there is also, I just want to say this and then I want to move on to, let's do at least one more verse today. I knew I wanted to spend a long time on that one just because I wanted to dig deeper into the interpretations of it, because there are so many. This is the reason why there are so many interpretations is this is the rabbi's opportunity to summarize Abraham's life in a word, right? Whatever bakol means. And so they're going to take every chance to try to explain what a good life is and what it means to be blessed bakol. So that's why I think these deeper ideas do make sense to be put here, because they help explain what Abraham did with his life. I want to bring especially one interpretation that seems to me important, but in order to do that, you have to look back at chapter 15. Chapter 15 begins as follows, okay? Sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. He said, you with me? Fear not, Abraham, I'm a shield to you, your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless, and the one in charge of my household is Damesek Eliezer. Okay? Now fast forward to 24. Verse 2. And Abraham said to the senior servant of his household who had charge of all that he owned, put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of Abraham and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to the land of my birth and get a wife for my son Isaac. Now, a couple of things. First of all, why does he say don't take a wife from the Canaanites? The obvious reason is that you don't want a wife from among pagan people, right? Abraham is afraid at the very beginning that the whole mission is going to be torpedoed because he's going to marry a Canaanite, right? And he's going to bring home a Canaanite, and then you'll have to have Canaanite holidays, and it'll be, you know, the whole thing. But the Orach Chaim very interestingly says, Eliezer sees that Abraham's getting old. He's been in charge of his household the whole time, right? What does he really want? He wants to marry his family into Abraham's family, which makes sense now that Isaac is about to get married, because then things will just continue as they've always been, and he'll continue to run Abraham's household. And so Abraham, rather than saying to him, I want you to know that your family is not an option, just says no Canaanites, which I always thought was kind of an interesting, you know, an interesting thought, because the truth is that we think in terms of social classes, but social classes can be fluid, especially when you're the only person who's an Israelite around. And the second point that I want to make that's also a really nice interpretation of this verse is, you'll notice, I don't remember who says this, so I can't quote it in their name. You'll notice that when Abraham puts Eliezer in charge of all of his household, he doesn't make him swear. He only makes him swear when he's off to get a daughter for his son. And they said, this is the reverse of the way people usually treat things. They are incredibly careful about who handles their money. And they will interview anyone who handles their money, you know, to the ends of the earth. But when it comes time, and they're talking specifically about men, but when it comes time for who the children marry, that's really the wife's business. They don't really pay very much attention to that. They let somebody else handle that, right? And he says, Abraham considered just the reverse. His money wasn't important, but who his children marry was really important. So he didn't make Eliezer swear when he was handling the money, because that's just money. But when it comes to getting a wife for Isaac, he wanted to make sure that he had oversight of this process, which I thought was kind of a neat. Yes?
Two questions. If Abraham is the first Israelite, then who's he going back to? Because no one.
Well, he has family. He's the first Israelite, but he's going to marry people in his family, because then they'll. But he'll be able to influence whoever is in his family. They don't come already with, you know, they know Abraham, and these are his siblings. And remember that there is a, remember that Terach was already on his way to Israel when Abraham, you know, when he died and Abraham completed the journey. So maybe there was some monotheistic influence already in the family. We'll come to that more later, yeah.
Then the second question is it possible, or does it play into the fact that they had just come back from the Akedah, that Isaac and Abraham never, Isaac maybe wouldn't trust if Abraham went himself, or, you know, that there's some reason why he's not, besides being old,
it's right, it's possible.
There's, you know, he wants to make sure that there's someone that is familiar and trustworthy, but...
It is possible that Isaac would trust Eliezer more than he would trust Abraham at this point. You know, the business about Abraham and Isaac not trusting each other is purely speculative, obviously, because we don't know. They never speak again, but maybe the Bible just doesn't report any more conversations between them. It's hard to say, but yeah, it may be. It also may be that Abraham is concerned. One of the interpretations is that Abraham is concerned that, and you'll see this later on, I'll elaborate on it when we come to it, but Abraham may be concerned that his presence there will distort the process, because he's a rich, powerful guy. Whereas if Eliezer goes, they won't, the way that they act towards Eliezer, what they say to Eliezer, how they treat Eliezer will be a better test of what the family is like than if Abraham goes. So, possible, I don't know. And also, the other thing that we don't know is what was the usual custom? Did the father usually go, or did he usually send someone? We don't know. Yeah.
Speaking of what we do and don't know, how do we know that this conversation took place? There were two people involved. How did we get this conversation?
The narrator. The narrator told us. I mean, this goes back to who wrote this and why they wrote it, and I don't want to revisit that right now, because we've done it several times in the class, but. It is the convention of the omnipotent narrator, right? Which is what you always, in any novel that you open, in any story that you open, you have to, I mean, the first decision that the writer has to make is, do I describe the action or am I in the action? Is it a first-person narration or an omnipotent narration? According to tradition, God wrote this, so God knows what happened, right? Okay? So what does he have him do? First of all, he has him swear, he has him put his hand under my thigh, right? And what is under my thigh? Come on, people. What's S? Exactly. Exactly. It is by the, what they call in the literature on this, the generative organ, right? That's what it's called. Because that's where you swear if you're swearing with a human being. And that's an ancient Near Eastern custom. Right? If you swear to somebody, you don't put your hand on their heart, you don't put your hand on their head, you put your hand on their generative organ, or right near their generative organ. Because that's, I think that first of all, it's particularly appropriate because he's going to find a wife for Abraham, and second, because that's just the convention. I mean, that really binds you by swearing to what is... what is delicate and precious? How about that?
How about the original covenant with God?
Yes, right. And the circumcision, obviously. The way that God does circumcision is a sort of echo of that same idea. With apologies to Mel Brooks, who said that actually the brain is the most important organ. He has a long routine about that. He says, look, what do you care if somebody comes over and messes, he calls them your gentles, messes with you and your gentles, a momentary thing. He says, but you don't want someone coming over stroking your brain. You write out the wrong check, you'll lose money. So, He said, if God intended the gentles to be more important than the brain, he would have put a skull over the gentles. But this is all Mel Brooks. This is not, I won't do the whole album. But I could, yes, God knows. I wasted a lot of hours with comedy albums. Speaking of which, David Steinberg, whose comedy I actually also memorized when I was a kid, is coming November 28th in a little less than a month. Here to Sinai Temple, and if you've never heard him, he had years of a stand-up comedy routine, and then he became a director, directed many of the Seinfelds and many other shows that you've watched, and he should be fascinating to listen to. He used to do all these Bible routines, which were great, because he started off apparently as a Hebrew school teacher before he became famous. So anyway, the Eliezer says to him, what if the woman doesn't consent to follow me to this land? Shall I take your son back to the land from which you came? And Abraham answered him, on no account must you take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from my native land, promised me an oath, saying, I will assign this land to you and your offspring, and he will send an angel before you, and you will get a wife for my son from there. And if the woman doesn't consent to follow you, you'll be clear of your oath to me, but don't take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Master Abraham and swore to him as he was bidden. So this gives you another reason why Abraham might not want to go. Maybe he doesn't want to go back there. Maybe he just doesn't want to go back, right? He thinks it's okay to send his servant there, but he won't let Isaac go back to that land, and he won't go back to that land. He is quit of the land of his ancestors. And so even though his family is the likeliest source of a wife, well, I'm just thinking this morning, if you look, I think it was just posted this morning, maybe it was yesterday, it was either yesterday or this morning, there was an article about Judaism and intelligence on Slate magazine, which is an online magazine at slate.com, and it talks about inbreeding among Jews and the degree of inbreeding among Jews, and says that sometimes inbreeding produces different genetic characteristics. It can produce nasty diseases like Tay-Sachs, but it can also produce higher levels of competence in this, that, or the other thing. And the average, for example, for Ashkenazi Jews, the average verbal IQ is 122. And the average IQ among people is 100. Right? The average IQ among Ashkenazi Jews in general is 115 to 117, which is obviously much higher than. But the question is, of course, what are you measuring? And what do you consider intelligence? Because intelligence can be lots and lots of different things. But if you're measuring for verbal adeptness, it may well be that among a literate culture, a culture that lives in books, right, that inbreeding would breed for that. Because going back to a man with a large fortune may be in want of a wife, the most desirable in Jewish, for much of Jewish history, the most desirable mate was a book-learned man, right?
What time does Slate come up on the day?
Oh, it's always up.
I know.
What, that article? Just find it. Just go to slate.com. It's there. You don't need much. I mean, if I can find it on the internet because I was bred for low computer intelligence, then you can find it on the internet. Just go to slate.com. But anyway, so because, by the way, Jews score low on spatial visual things. So that, which is strange actually, because so many chess masters have been Jewish, and there are always going to be exceptions. But that's the skill that you need, for example, for chess is spatial visual. That for chess and interior design. But nonetheless, anyway, so you can read the article. It's based on a very long article in Commentary magazine by Charles Murray, who's an expert in intelligence and is not Jewish, about why he believes that Jews score higher on IQ tests. And I don't know if that's online, but you can probably find that as well. So, all right. What? What's that? Anything else? Any other questions, comments? Yes, please. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about, and this will also give, this idea of receiving Also, those of you who can come on Tuesday at Lunch and Learn, I'm starting a series of classes on Masters of Jewish Mysticism, of Kabbalah. And the reason I mention that is because the receiving idea is a very Kabbalistic idea. I shouldn't say it that way. Is an idea that is developed very much in the Kabbalah. I don't want to suggest it's only a mystical idea, but the Kabbalah uses a lot with receiving. And the basic scheme in the Kabbalah is that it's Luria's idea, that the Sfirot, the emanations of God, that which comes out from God, are really vessels. And God's energy pours into the vessels, right? And when the world was made, there was a Shvirat HaKelim, a breaking of the vessels. And that's why there is a broken world and you need Tikkun Olam. You have to be able to repair the world. Tikkun Olam really was a mystical concept. It didn't originally mean heal the bay, right? It originally meant the tikkun of the vessels so that they can hold the sparks once again. But this notion is that there is a life force in the world, there's light in the world, like those sparks, and that human beings can become vessels that receive that light. And the best way I can put it, and a nice way to end the class today, is to tell this beautiful story that David Aaron tells about his going to, and I've told the story before, but it's really a terrific story, about going to a class in Jerusalem. There was this ongoing mystical class in Jerusalem, and he decided one day he was going to go to the class because he'd heard about it. So he walked into the class, and the class, everybody's already sitting there, and the teacher goes like this to him, like, stop, apparently there's a test to get into the class. So he stops at the door, and the teacher walks over with an apple, and he hands him the apple, and David reaches for it, and the teacher pulls it away, and he goes like this, and then again he hands him the apple, so he reaches more gently for the apple, and the teacher pulls it away, and now David, he's embarrassed, he doesn't know what to do, and he doesn't know how to get into the class, and he looks at the class, and one of them goes like this. So the teacher holds out the apple and he goes like this and he drops it in his hands. In other words, if you're going to come into the class, don't come to grab, come to receive, which is a very different way of approaching, right, how you learn from someone and from something. So I think that that's part of what it was saying, is that we see Abraham as a great actor in history, right? He fights battles and he gets promises and so on, but the Mea Shiloach sees him essentially as a vessel that received God's sparks in this world, and that's what made him unique. Okay. All right, thank you.